Elizabeth Baird is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all these skills to address the subjects that we grapple with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Happy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Tuesday, Tyler.
How are you today?
I am feeling, if I tapped into my feelings chart in my head, I would say I am feeling curious.
Okay.
And comfortable.
Great.
And full of anticipation.
Okay. I'm all about it.
Don't you think that that would be a nice thing to post in the studio as a feelings chart? Just like of your face. So that you can kind of tap in every now and then. It's like, where am I on my feelings chart today?
It sounds exactly like something you would say.
Well, one of my friends who actually has been on the show with us, Megan Gallagher, she has a business called Out of the Box Parenting. And I just used Megan's maiden name, so that's not helpful. But Out of the Box Parenting, remember she was on talking about it. And she developed a feelings chart, and it's all pictures of her daughter making the faces of all the different feelings. And so she created it, I don't know, with some sort of program, and then printed out. And so it hangs in their house. And so her to help her daughter, you know, learn her emotional intelligence to be able to pick out those. So I thought it'd be kind of fun for like the KCBX employees. We could make feelings charts, maybe just of all of Frank's face and then some of yours. And
I'm thinking maybe one next to my desk because I get a lot of drop-ins. And so that way when people walk by, I can just point exactly to where I am on the chart.
Feelings
so,
chart, exactly.
You know, not
I am
to come
feeling
up to my
Frank's
desk.
Angry face. Walk away. But yeah, so that's what we're gonna talk, not about feelings charts today, but we're going to actually talk about tapping into the experiences that we have in the natural world and paying a little more attention, because it is mental health awareness month. And so I'm trying to drop things in each week over the course of May to kind of remind us about mental wellness and how we can be more proactive in caring for our mental health and well-being, things that we can do easily at home that don't really require going to an expert or paying a lot of money going through a program. You know, talk therapy is a wonderful tool. There are a lot of different programs and groups that are doing wonderful things, but not everyone has time or the finances or the wherewithal to get into something that's structured. But we all need to every day take some time to tap into our mental health and well-being, even if it's something as small as looking at your feelings chart and kind of noticing, hey, here's how I'm feeling today, and then recognizing that that feeling changes, that you might start at one point on the feelings chart in the morning and then change to different feelings throughout the day, and then how the next day you feel differently. Because if we could step out a little bit and observe our feelings, you would recognize that it's very fluid, those emotions that go through us day in and day out. And if we could trust that even if we're having a feelings day that's lower on the feelings chart or a little more uncomfortable, that will shift as the days go by. And so in honoring Mental Health Awareness Month, I'm encouraging you to choose one or two very small things you could do each day that makes a little bit of an improvement. I'm not asking for big changes, because I think a lot of times when we talk about, you know, improving our mental health or taking care of our physical health, we jump into big things. Like, I'm going to become a vegan, or I'm going to start training for a marathon, or, you know, I'm going to meditate for a half hour a day. And all of those in some way are setups for failure, because if you've never run even a mile, the idea that you're going to train for a marathon is tough to jump in and do. And if you've decided you're going to meditate for a half hour, but you have a hard time focusing on three breaths in a row, then it's going to be a tough thing to take on. And so when we talk about mental wellness, it's really about those small things that we do intentionally every day, things that you're already doing. And I mentioned this last week as well, that when you eat a piece of fruit, that's good for you. It's medicine for your body and it's medicine for your mind. And so if you just take a moment before you bite into whatever it is you're going to eat and you say, this is good for me, this is good for who I am, that message gets to your psyche, and that's mental wellness. Every time you hug your children or hug your spouse, right before you reach in for that squeeze, if you can say to yourself, this is good for my heart and good for this person I love, and that psychic message sits in you in a deeper place. And so it's just tapping in mindfully to those things that we're already doing day to day, and then talking about and thinking about other small things you can do that add to your mental wellness, that kind of build that mental wellness bank account so that when you go through times that are really a challenge, when you're really struggling on the feelings chart, you have this bank of good feelings that you've been building on for weeks and weeks and weeks that you can draw on to get you through tough times. Because mental health, like physical health, is cumulative. And so the time that we put in to taking care of our mental health and well-being pays off in other areas of our lives and in many ways can inoculate us from deeper, more disturbing or destructive, disordered periods of time like depression or generalized anxiety disorder or eating disorders, because they don't just appear out of nowhere. You don't just wake up one morning with major depressive disorder or generalized anxiety or panic anxiety, although people would argue that panic anxiety does just come over you. But generally, there is a period of time where you've depleted yourself in some way, whether it's through lack of sleep, lack of emotional connection, lack of service to others, lack of time with meaningful relationships or meaningful work. And that kind of lack of attention to those areas starts to build up, and then you find yourself struggling. So Mental Health Awareness Month began in 1949. Since 1949, there have been over 50 different types of therapeutic approaches that have been recognized, from CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, to psychodynamic therapy or psychoanalysis, Jungian-based therapies, to humanistic or Rogerian therapies, family therapy, gestalt therapy, feminist therapy, solution-focused therapy, rational emotive behavior therapy, brief therapy, expressive therapies, play therapies, and we continue to see other types of therapeutic interventions emerging. And one of the most quickly growing or fastest growing areas of therapeutic intervention are the nature-based therapies. And there's two kind of segments of the nature-based therapies. The first one is ecotherapy. Ecotherapy is also called nature therapy, and it's part of the applied practice that's associated with the growing field of eco-psychology, which studies and researches the benefits of nature on the human psyche. And ecotherapy is the practice, the applied practice of those findings. And what's interesting about ecotherapy is that it stems from this belief that people, each of us, are a part of the web of life, that we're all interconnected, that we are not separate from nature, that we are part of the natural world, and that our psyches are not isolated or separate from the environment in any way. And so this kind of therapy is informed by that systems therapy, that we are all interconnected and the actions of one impacts all. And so if we're interconnected with the natural world, that the health and well-being of the natural world also impacts our individual mental health and well-being, and that our mental health and well-being can also have positive impact on the natural world. So the core of ecotherapy is finding a connection with the earth, like literally a connection with the earth, being able to tune in and almost feel, you know how you feel the vibrations of your loved ones, you know, you can sense that they love you, you can sense those good feelings when you think about them. Well, the same thing with ecotherapy is to get people tuned in to feeling good about the earth and the natural world, that we can close our eyes and breathe in and recall the smells of a beautiful place out in nature or flowers, or we can hear the sounds of birds, or we can feel ourselves grounded in a beautiful place. So this idea of being able to connect with the earth is the core work for clinicians, because they believe that earth has its own self-righting capacity, right? That it's able to self-heal, self-correct, which operates through a complex series of systems. And that if people can harmonize with these different systems, they also can self-correct or self-right. Where, you know, in ancient cultures or primitive cultures, they would send people out on walkabouts or on vision quests, you know, out into the natural world until they got right with themselves. And that idea is that they got into harmony with the rhythms of the natural world. And there have been studies that supported this work, showing that 40 minutes of time out in nature reduced depression symptoms by 71%, as opposed to just taking a walk in a mall or in an urban area, reduced symptoms by 45%. And the idea of ecotherapy is associated with things like horticultural therapy, growing a garden, animal-assisted therapies, getting people involved in physical exercise in the natural environment, getting involved in conservation activities, taking action, on nature meditations, which I mentioned before, meditating on actual aspects of the natural world. And then the other piece of the nature-based therapies are the different ways that we interact in the natural world that can enhance our mental health. And I've talked before about some of these. Forest therapy, which is known as Shinrin-yoku, forest bathing, earthing, which is moving barefoot through the world. The International Surf Therapy Organization has programs all over the world. We have one locally at Operation Surf, getting people out into the water, ocean therapy, reducing PTSD symptoms and depression. There's a program of hike therapy or hiker therapy that's now emerging. And so all of these different nature-based therapies are available to help us maintain and create a baseline of wellness to carry us through our lives. And so to get more deeply involved in this idea of how nature is healing and how we can maintain our own mental health and well-being and that of our children as well, because we as adults are the ones that are modeling these behaviors for our children. So part of our work is to get right ourselves with the natural world and then show that and model it to our children. And to get more into kind of the science of this and the research behind it, I have invited Emily Sabin, who is the director of Camp Natoma, to be my guest today. Emily has a BS in environmental systems and a minor in human development from UC San Diego. Emily also has a master's degree in education with a focus on nature and ecological literacy. Emily spent a semester in New Zealand in the National Outdoor Leadership School learning backcountry skills. She's also married and a mother to three young boys. So she has a lot of information and experience in working with the natural world and how we can develop ecological literacy in our children and how we can move forward in a time where there's a lot of eco-anxiety about environmental destruction and climate change and habitat loss. And so I'm going to tap into Emily today to say, hey, how do we reduce that eco-anxiety and introduce children to the natural world in ways that will help not only our children as they grow into the adults that'll be caring for the environment, but also to interact with the natural world in ways that are healing for the planet? And you'll also be involved to be part of our conversation. Our number is 805-781-3875. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. You can reach me on my Facebook page or follow us on Instagram, Elizabeth_TRT. You can always send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. Listen to previous shows at kcbx.org and podcast our show so you can listen at your convenience by visiting any ways that you can source podcasts, look for a Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, and hit subscribe. I'm looking forward to this conversation. I look forward to having you participate. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
On a poor young country boy, Mother Nature's son. All day long, I'm sitting singing songs for everyone. Sit beside a mountain stream, see her waters rise. Listen to the pretty sound of music as she
Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And welcome, Emily Sabin.
Thank you for having me today.
All right, so Emily is the director of Camp Natoma. You've been camp director at Natoma for 10 years.
Yes.
But you also grew up going to camp.
I did. I grew up on the Central Coast. I went to Camp Natoma as a child. My family has been involved for many generations with this outdoor nature-based camp.
And so for people that aren't familiar with Camp Natoma, let's just give an overview of where the program is and what's offered for children and for families.
Absolutely. Camp Natoma is a nonprofit outdoor summer camp for children. We mostly have participants from San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara counties, and we serve campers with week-long overnight camp sessions. When you think of a traditional, rustic, very rustic outdoor experience, Camp Natoma is it. Literally, we sleep outside under the stars. That means that the beds are outside underneath the oak trees. The campers and staff, myself included as the camp director, we live outside all summer. And the campers get to participate in a variety of outdoor activities, some that are just purely fun and recreational, archery, tomahawks, swimming, arts and crafts, but also some that are very intentional in allowing kids to explore the natural oak woodland that our camp exists in. It's a 360-acre camp with a Franklin Creek running through it. Franklin Creek eventually flows into Lake Nacimiento. And kids have the opportunity to learn by hands-on experiences, by curiosity and exploration, as well as design curriculum that teaches them how to be a steward of the natural world and learn about the local plants and animals that live there.
So what inspired you to take all of your education and put it into Camp Natoma?
Well, it was an interesting path that I took to end up being the camp director. In college, I was an environmental science major, and I also was an athlete, and so being outside during the summer made sense. So I worked at Camp Natoma. I got a job, a summer job. Eventually, I met my husband, future husband, working there, and we found a passion for what the camp had potential to do. The program was much smaller, and we just kind of internally had this gut feeling that camp could be bigger and better and serve more campers while staying true to its roots of the natural world. So through a wild course of gaining a teaching credential, working seasonal jobs, also in the outdoor education field, becoming an elementary school teacher, and then realizing that I could continue my career full-time in the outdoor summer camp world, I took a path towards realizing that this is where kids today need to be. And it combined kind of my passion for working outdoors, for working with kids and young adults. Most of our staff are college age, as well as, growing a business and being involved in our community and connected in many ways.
And so what is the overall mission statement or vision that you have for camp and for what kids are going to gain when they come up to camp?
The Camp Natoma slogan is sleep under the stars, connect with nature, and be creative. So the three aspects really are getting kids literally outside, out from the fluorescent lights, away from their screens, and immersed in nature. And then we want them to connect. And connect with nature is more than just with the natural world. It's connecting with each other on a personal level, connecting with the role models that are our staff, and building those communication skills, face-to-face emotional interactions. And then the be creative component allows us to have a lot of fun in terms of cooperative games that build 21st century skills. Of course, arts and crafts and performances around the campfire give opportunities for being creative.
And so given kind of the topic for today that I brought up about, nature-based therapies and eco-psychology and kind of this emerging research that's showing the benefits of interacting with the natural world, but then juxtapose that with kind of the fear that is being imposed on young people and adults around climate change and habitat loss and destruction around the world, and this growing piece of eco-anxiety, they're calling it, that people are almost in some ways moving away from the natural world because it's so hard to be out in the world and seeing it be destroyed around you. And so how do you, twofold, as a camp director, but as a mother of three sons, how do you encourage people or how do you envision moving forward with those two kind of competing things, the importance of the natural world, but the eco-anxiety and fear of loss?
It's a tough challenge to overcome. And I think as I've become a mom, and I've also seen many children grow up over, you know, 10 or 12 summers at camp and then maybe become our staff when they reach college age, it's an interesting evolution for a child, whether it's my own child that, you know, I have a 2-year-old right now who's curious about everything and doesn't understand any larger perspective of eco-anxiety. It's all just something to explore and have fun with. And then as they move into the school age where they've been exposed more to the fears, and that's where we see campers, even our youngest campers, come in with really irrational fears about the dangers of living outdoors or just being outdoors and hiking or putting their toes in the creek. And then moving on to high schoolers who are starting to understand more of the global perspective of destruction, or maybe they've seen in their own communities open space that's now no longer open space, and that sadness maybe that where they used to play as a child doesn't exist anymore. And seeing how the curiosity about the natural world gets replaced with the fear. We try to focus at camp on allowing kids to have positive experiences with being curious, and that even the staff member doesn't need to have the right answer about, like, what type of rock is this or what kind of bug is this. It doesn't really matter the scientific name. It more matters that you're connecting and you're realizing that it's not just bugs, but when you get down on your hands and knees, there's like 8 different colors and shapes and sizes and a whole breadth of questions that you can come up with to feel connected and to learn more.
And so you're an educator as well. I mean, you have a teaching credential and you worked in the schools. How did you see some of the, you know, the, because I think a lot of the message about the environment and the natural world and being in the natural world is taught to children through their parents. With your interaction with parents, did you see them, you know, wondering how to get involved with their children or how to teach them about nature, the natural world? Because it's hard to teach something that you maybe haven't spent a lot of time in yourself.
Yes, I think that I was sort of getting there with what I was just saying earlier about you don't have to know the right answer to be out in nature. And that's where the fulfillment, I think, comes from in spending time outdoors. You can go for a walk on the beach and you cannot know a single name of the shell on the ground or type of fish that might be swimming out in the ocean and still reap the emotional benefits and the joy and the maybe relaxation from just that time being in nature. And I think that that's true in various settings here on the Central Coast. A lot of people think of the beach as a place to go for a walk and relax. And so for parents, as they're trying to teach their kid about what is our environmental status, what is the natural world mean to our family, mm-hmm. it's a conflict because there's not enough time in a day to get your kid outside every day in a natural world, especially if you don't have access to it in your backyard. There's the constant media message about the terrible things that are going on in the world. And then there's this disconnect from the educational component, right? We look at the statistics about who's studying science and what types of kids are studying, want to study science, and how is it related to their day-to-day experiences. And even in the 5th and 6th grades, which is where I spent most of my time teaching, if kids haven't spent a significant amount of time being curious in the natural world, not being taught, just being curious, there's not a lot of context for learning the science curriculum. Mm-hmm. And that the science curriculum makes way more sense if there's the context of knowing what it feels like to have the water in a creek ripple around your toes, or hearing the birds making their mating calls, or any small glimpse into the natural world makes kids more interested in learning about science.
And so you keep using the term curiosity. So clearly that's at the core of, I guess, nature-based therapies or nature-based work, is igniting a kind of curiosity that children, I'd imagine children and adults, follow. Because I'm not a bird watcher, but I'm always fascinated by people who become bird watchers, because clearly they're following this curiosity about what's out there flying in the trees. And so how do we ignite that curiosity? Like you said, by 5th or 6th grade, it's probably not too late. It's probably a great time to ignite curiosity. But how do you introduce that to adults and children?
That's a really difficult question because I think curiosity is a natural trait of small children. Mm-hmm. And what is it that makes us lose our curiosity in different departments? I mean, as an adult, I'm curious about a lot of things, but you start to diminish your curiosities maybe because we become dependent on information being told to us, or there's a constant availability of information. So there's no longer a need to wonder when you can just go look it up. But when you wonder or when you're curious, that's how you kind of contextualize and assign value to what you're thinking about, especially in terms of the natural world.
So the eco-psychologist would say then that curiosity is a way of interacting and becoming part of the system, that when you're curious about the natural world, you're also then curious about your human psyche and how you feel in different environments or what kind of experience you have in that moment. And when you, I'm assuming that that's kind of where that would go for our therapeutic benefit, is that if you're curious about how it feels to be, we feed in a creek, then you're curious about why does this feel good in my body and why don't I do more things that feel good inside my body, and when my body feels good, then I'm more apt to want to explore more in that environment. Like it kind of becomes this whole experience. If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. My guest is Emily Zabin. She is director of Camp Natoma. She's here today to talk about her experience in environmental systems, environmental education. She has a master's in education with a focus on nature and ecological literacy. And we're going to be opening up the phone line soon, 805-781-3875. If you have any questions for Emily about how to get your kids more excited about the natural world, or you as an adult, how to get more excited about the natural world, or questions about camp, 805-781-3875. We're going to take a breath and come back in a moment to answer your calls and continue our conversation. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Mother Earth lives on the ocean. Mother Earth sails on the sea. I am blessed with her devotion. Mother Earth provides for me. When the grasslands crave for water and the harvest needs sunlight, these are times when I am helpless. Mother Earth makes all things right. Green trees grow on mountain tops. Birds still sing when morning comes. Though I treat her carelessly, Mother Earth still cares for me. Mother Earth still cares for me. I am going on a journey, and I pray all things end well.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And we're going on a journey today talking about nature-based therapies and the natural world and eco-psychology and ecotherapy and all things about the natural world and how it impacts our mental health. And my guest is Emily Zabin. And you and I talked before that we really wanted to focus on the positives of these natural experiences and how we see reductions in depression, anxiety, conduct disorders, ADHD symptoms in children in very small doses in the natural world. And it doesn't have to be going off into Yosemite, or, you know, these things can be found in the backyard. And one of the studies that I found fascinating was in classrooms, if they had the kids go run around the track and stop and like look for a stick or a leaf or something, and just 10 minutes before class, the behavior in the classroom was reduced, you know, the ADHD behavior was reduced by like 75%. So we see instantly that children become more calm when they have experiences outside. But I think for a lot of parents, they have their own kind of anxieties. Maybe you never were a hiker or never went camping or never, you know, you might walk on the beach, but you never felt comfortable swimming in the ocean. So how do we help parents get more comfortable so they in turn can help their children feel more comfortable?
I think there's a lot of opportunities. We're so fortunate here on the Central Coast for families to explore in just baby step ways and in small ways and check things out where you don't need a lot of equipment or knowledge or preparation. And those places are our state parks, our regional parks, our county parks. And also knowing that you can go out there and just go for a short walk and there's going to be things that spark your interest or change how your body might feel. And the way you mentioned about school children being able to go for a run quickly before they go back into the classroom sparked my thought about parents call me all the time about their child coming to summer camp and being concerned about their child being successful at camp, whether that's homesickness or following, you know, they have maybe attention deficit disorder or other behavioral challenges in the classroom. And I can tell that in their gut, these parents know that camp would be good for their kid. But they're worried that their kid might not fit into the mold of what the expectations are at camp. And over, I reassure parents, and then we see it in action, that actually kids are awesome and thrive at camp because it provides them the things that their soul and their body need to be happy. And that's structure. Kids need structure, and camp is structured. But the structure allows their body to be very physically active, and it allows their social-emotional components and needs to be met because they're constantly building relationships with others. And I have to believe through the studies that we've read and just from anecdotal evidence watching kids at camp that there's something about breathing the fresh air and getting dirty and going for creek walks that helps kids grow and feel healthy and energetic. And even kids whose parents warn me that they're going to have behavioral problems at camp, like they note it on their health form and their counselor or their staff members get kind of a heads up. And at the end of the week, we kind of look at each other and scratch our head and be like, wait, their mom just was so worried about them having these behavior problems. And this kid was a wonderful camper the whole time. And I think that's because we're providing them an environment that is actually the natural environment that their bodies are meant to be in, to climb, to hike, to jump, to splash, to think, to laugh, be creative.
Be part of the ecosystem.
Be part of the world, yeah.
And one of the things I noticed on your education was ecological literacy. And tell me what that is, because that's a term I really don't know.
So my degree was in education, but we had the opportunity to specialize into our interests. And this was at the beginning of my tenure as camp director. And I was inspired to learn more about the Children in Nature movement. I know that we've discussed in the past nature deficit disorder and getting kids outside for green time as a prescription for mental challenges and emotional and behavioral difficulties. And so I wanted to research what the natural world can really do for a child. And I was able to incorporate observations at Camp Natoma and curriculum and programming and to learn about the breadth of studies that are really occurring now about how various types of nature play and environmental education shape a child for more success in their personal well-being as well as their academic success. So the two components that really stood out to me were this, like, as I said the word curious a lot, is this play in nature. It doesn't need to be structured. It doesn't need to be teaching science. It just needs to be play where kids realize when they find a stick that looks this way, it's dead and it's going to break. Mm-hmm. Or if they find a rock that's flat, they can skip it on the water. Just pure play combined with more structured environmental education where it's not sitting in a classroom reading a textbook about science. It's immersing a child in the natural world while helping them understand the scientific components that are related to what they're seeing.
And so setting that foundation or that core of curiosity then kind of lends itself into adulthood, because then when you see adults who are struggling with anxiety or depression or a lot of the, you know, eating disorders, the things that we see coming into our offices quite often, we'll say, well, go for a walk, get some exercise, you know, be with nature. And in general, people say, okay, yeah, I can do that. But then they take that information and they end up at the gym, or they take a hike, but they're not really in nature. They're just pounding the path as hard as they can to, you know, get their heart rate up. And so how, you know, one of the things I grapple with is that prescription that she talked about, because we see a lot of clinicians actually now writing prescriptions to be in nature, but it's much different than what I think a lot of people assume is be in nature, which is do a hard hike through the forest and really go into nature the way you'd watch a 2 or 3 year old go into nature, which is stop every 3 steps, which makes any sort of hike challenging for a parent. You have to kind of go into that experience with a different expectation, because every 2 or 3 steps, a 3 year old is going to find a rock or a bug or a stick or something that captures their curiosity. That setting that foundation for adults, what kind of opportunities at Camp Natoma, you know, do we have for the parents who would like their children to go to camp, but they have their own anxieties about the natural world? And so how do we introduce them to the natural world so they in turn feel safe bringing their kids?
Yeah, it's a complex question. So we have opportunities at Camp Natoma for the parents to learn about the program. Of course, I'm always available by phone or email to talk to parents about what their questions are and how we address campers and their needs in the outdoors. But we also have opportunities for camp families to come out to camp and check it out. One being we have a director's dinner on June 1st, and that's an opportunity for parents to come out, have a meal in our dining hall, go for a short nature walk, and just see it and realize that their kid can be safe and happy there for a week. We also have opportunities for volunteering and tours of the campsite throughout the coming weeks. I think that kids translate the message of what happened at camp in a really unique way to their parents, and that if parents can have trust in our organization, I always like to plug that we're accredited by the American Camp Association, and that's a really big seal of approval in terms of every operational component of a summer camp or a youth program. It covers us in the way we hire and train and screen our staff, our facilities, our transportation, our health and safety. We have on-site medical staff, our food service, and of course, our program quality. If parents can, through word of mouth and through our reviews and through conversations with myself, send their child to camp, I think that the way parents feel most connected to camp is by seeing the growth in their child. And they see that growth in their child in a variety of different ways. Maybe it's they come home and they're like, hey, Mom, I ate lentil soup and I liked lentils. And the parents are like, yeah, right. Or maybe they come home and they now want to go on hikes. And the kids themselves can kind of guide the family towards that. Or they come home with just a renewed sense of self-confidence and independence. And it's because of their time spent in nature. So I think that children often are the best messengers for showing how time in nature is beneficial to their well-being.
And then, of course, since it's that chicken and the egg, so I'm listening to you talk and I'm thinking of the yeah buts in my head. Yeah, but a lot of parents will say to me, I asked my kids if they wanted to go to camp and they said no. And so then the clinician in me says, well, your children can't know because they've never been exposed to camp. And so there's certain things we have to do as parents where we just say, you're going to do this.
Because this is good for you.
This is good for you. And so I think that's kind of that parental dance that we do, is that a lot of parents, you know, have to be a little more assertive in pushing these first experiences. And then maybe, you know, kind of starting from a young age, getting your children interested or excited about camp, or not just camp, but the outside world, so that they are ready for camp. And so, you know, I have put together kind of some ideas of simple things that parents could do to introduce the natural world. Because it doesn't have to be going to nature. And we always say that. It's like, we're going to go out to nature. And so it sounds like you're getting in the car and you're going, you know, far away to Pinnacles or something. But all you have to do is open the door. If you have any sort of size of a yard, you can create kind of a natural landscape. Take out your lawn is one of the first things people say. Take out the lawn, put in some plants that attract bees and bugs and birds, and have your kids just sit out in the backyard and watch what happens and keep an observation journal, write down anything that they see or collect things they see, build a bat box or a birdhouse or have a bird bath.
Worms. My boys love worms. And I think, I mean, my students used to love worms too. We did vermiculture in our classroom. And it's little things like that that spark their interest and help their hands get dirty and them roll up their pants. And that's a hobby that adults can have too. It has like a benefit to you personally if you're composting your kitchen waste. And yeah, those are really, really ways we can do it in our own backyard.
All right. So how do you introduce worms to your yard then? Because most of the time after it rains, you might see worms come up from the mud, but you're talking about like actively cultivating worms.
Well, yeah. I mean, my little boys, they love to dig worms after it rains, but they also, we've talked about, and we did for a short time, have a worm box where you can either get them from your own yard or you can get them on Craigslist or from the store and create a very simple worm box. You can do it yourself in an afternoon. Let's look on Pinterest or Google it. And it's a neat way to just have a glimpse of what's beneath the surface, right? It's just a small part of the natural world. It's really not that dirty or gross in
the
traditional sense.
Well, the microbes are good
sense.
For our immune system, right?
They're excellent for your immune system. Yeah, they say that kids that play outside and play in the dirt have far stronger immune systems than those that spend their time in a sanitized antibacterial plastic playground or playroom.
Well, and it's funny because parents work so hard to make sure that dirt never gets in their kids' mouth. But then some of the happiest babies are the ones, and I find it interesting because, you know, babies are very tactile and everything, and your 2.5-year-old as well. There's something drawing them to feel it, touch it, put it in their face, taste it, see if it's something worth eating. That's got to be part of our natural evolution or development.
I agree 100%.
If you're just tuning in, this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Our number is 805-781-3875. If you have any questions or comments, my guest is Emily Zabin, director of Camp Natoma. And Emily, what is the website if people want more information about camp?
It's Camp Natoma, which is NATOMA.org.
So I want to talk about a little of the heavier piece of the conversation. Again, the eco-anxiety piece. And I know I'm feeling it as a grandmother, you know, that I have a 3.5-year-old granddaughter and I'm looking at her and she loves being outdoors and is so excited to play and go to the creek and everything of the natural world. And then this little ache in my heart I have because I feel like I don't know what's going to be there for her in 20 years. And I'm wondering how you as a parent and your husband have thought about how will you introduce that or address that with your boys as they grow, and how can we help other parents kind of deal with their own heavy heart and still help their children learn to engage and love and participate in the environment?
I think it's a constant internal battle because so much of what I enjoy doing is time in nature, but every moment I'm working behind the computer screen and consuming plastics and, you know, making waste, it's like they are constantly going to be against each other when we think about the long-term future of our planet. And so thinking about the next generation or, the small babies and children of today or the next generation, it's just a depressing, sad, sad thought, not knowing where the world is going to be in several years from now. And so my strategy or my husband and I's strategy right now is really to help our children connect with the natural world and try not to use blanket statements like that's bad for the environment or that's healthy or that's not safe, because that's really not applicable when you as an individual can only do so much. But it's about understanding the bigger complexities of our interdependent societies and consumption patterns. But that if every child was given just the chance to be curious and play and at least enjoy their time outside as a kid, then that's the only way we're going to have any sort of mindset towards wanting to preserve it in the future.
Right, because there was a pretty big research study that was done that showed that as we move forward trying to deal with the change, climate, habitat, with species, that if children, the next generation, are not exposed to species of animals or the climate or the environment, they don't have any motivation to protect or conserve or to change their habits. And so ironically, since, you know, Earth Day started in 1971, instead of getting actually, you know, more devoted to conservation, there's a huge segment of our population that's kind of retreated almost out of fear. And then they watch things like Shark Week.
And feeling helpless,
which makes you retreat more. When we feel helpless or hopeless, we retreat. And so I think the big challenge is, how do we right that ship or expand the whole excitement or interest in, and it's not global protection, because again, Daniel Quinn, who wrote Ishma, would say the idea of protecting the environment means that we're separate from the environment and we're the stewards, instead of realizing that how do we protect the ecology of which we are a part of, which means our choices every day as humans not only impact our mental health and well-being, our physical health, but then everything around us.
So we've embraced the idea at Camp Natoma that kids need to know their local environment.
Okay.
Because it's more common for any age student, really, to know more about the cheetahs they did a report on or the humpback whales than they know about the coast live oak that grows in their backyard or about the bobcats that live in the open spaces here. And I think that that kind of feeds into this like larger picture global fear component. It's like, well, I can't really do anything about those cheetahs or whatever other endangered species they've done a lot of research on and can cite some facts on.
That just makes them sad and anxious.
It makes you feel sad and anxious. You feel disconnected. You haven't formed a relationship. Not that you have formed a relationship with a cheetah, but like, you don't understand that ecosystem because it's not connected to who you are and where you live. And so at Camp Natoma, we really work to help kids and our staff understand the local ecosystem. There's a great organization who's doing this in the classrooms right now called Learning Among the Oaks. It's part of the Nature Conservancy. And they have some really great programs going on in schools where the students are becoming what they call oak ambassadors. And the kids are getting a breadth of really valuable and relevant knowledge of their local backyard ecosystems and trails. We had them come out to Natoma a few summers ago. But it's this connectedness to your local environment that I think inspires and empowers you to not feel hopeless, mm-hmm. right? Because if there's an invasive pest that's killing off an oak tree or some other local species, it's going to make a lot more sense on how we as a community can preserve it, or how our actions maybe are polluting a certain species of sea stars in the ocean, because that's our local community and we are so tied to it. And so building our youth's knowledge of what's relevant to them may have far more long-term benefits to our whole planet Earth rather than this isolated amount of knowledge of like one endangered species that lives on a different continent.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense that children tend to see. And again, Shark Week comes up for me because that same research report I was talking about, Kids in Nature, said that children are developing these unnatural fears, overwhelming fears of any body of water, because they watch things like Shark Week that make it look like sharks can come out of, you know, your creek or out of the toilet or your bathtub, you know, out of the ocean. And so then children develop these unnatural fears of just the pond that's, you know, down the street. Or so to try to, I love the idea of trying to make it local. And if parents, you know, again, not everyone can afford to send their children to camp or, you know, to do some of the outdoor programming that's available, some of the things they can do at home are like create a scavenger hunt or, you know, a collection bucket. So just send the kids out in the backyard or the park and have them look for things that they're curious about, and then bring them back and then look through the bucket and talk about what they found and why they're curious about it. What are some other just like quick and easy things that parents could do?
I think exposing yourself as an adult or if you have children, your children, to just different nooks and crannies of our local community. I mean, there are so many places to explore that all have their own unique features, whether it's like the windswept coast of, you know, San Simeon, or the tide pools, or the open space in SLO. They're all slightly different, but they're all interconnected and they're interdependent. And going out for a walk there is going to make you think and feel different things in each location.
And as I started the show talking about the idea of getting out into nature, that clinicians will often say, get out to nature and you'll feel better. And then people don't really understand what does that mean, getting out into nature? And some of the studies with the ecotherapy were less about, you know, there is hiker therapy and getting out the hike in hiking, but it was less about hiking for getting your cardio up and more about the hiking of hearing your footsteps on the trail and the sounds of what you're coming across. You know, instead of going out for your hike with headphones and then listening to music, you don't wear the headphones and you listen to the sounds and you then the smells and really allow yourself to become completely engulfed in that experience. And then another kind of meditative exercise, which I think would be great for families, which is to lay out somewhere and look at the sky and start cloud watching and, you know, calling out different shapes that they could see or animals they might, whatever they see in the clouds, and that kind of immersion into just breathing in and experiencing the sky above, or finding a tree when you're walking down the street or in the park and look really closely at the colors in the bark. And it's, you know, that, as I said at the beginning, wellness is about just the intention of doing things that are good for you. And so if your intention is, hey, we're going to go out and try to find a beautiful leaf, the most beautiful leaf you can find, and then kids will really get involved in trying to find that leaf. And then the other thing I want to talk about is the importance of getting involved in conservation activities. And you mentioned, you know, getting involved locally, because then that makes sense. If kids are working on a project to, say, secure a nature preserve or to clean up a local creek, that taking action in those conservation activities really show great long-term mental health benefits, because service to others or service to something greater than ourselves is a huge prescription for reducing anxiety and depression. So what are some conservation activities that you suggest?
There's a lot of organizations in our community that offer ways to get involved. I can think of a lot that have to do with our coast and keeping the beaches clean, and the Surf Rider, and the aquarium down in Avila Beach. They sponsor a lot of events that affect all of our waterways, the creeks, the ponds, the lakes, and the ocean. Is an easy way to get out on a Saturday afternoon and make a big difference. Trail work is another one, where we as a community have to work together to keep our open space that we all access preserved and well-kept. And so there's lots of opportunities for trail work, both through city and larger entities.
And then you mentioned science and making science kind of putting it more in context with the day-to-day. So as a teacher and a mom, what are some fun, easy kind of science-y projects you can do just at home in your yard or at the park?
One that I've done with my older students and my young children is to map off like a 2-foot by 2-foot square area. It can be like an overgrown patch in your yard or somewhere in a public open space, and try to get to know every square inch of that space. And you can journal it, you can sketch it, you can just talk about it with, if it's a child, or a partner, and then come back to it on a day that's really foggy, or come back to it after it's been pouring rain, or come back to it in a different season, and compare the differences. And it can just be a small patch of like your yard or an open space.
And one of the prescriptions of the ecotherapist was nature meditations, which is great to start with children if you want to help them get mindful, learn how to calm their bodies if they might be feeling anxious at school or anywhere. And to start off with one simple like a picture of nature, a place you've been, or something that you brought back from nature, whether it's a feather or a plant or some rocks, and have the child just sit and kind of look at that piece of the picture or the piece of nature and kind of breathe in and out and look at the piece and just kind of focus on it for just a minute. And then you'll notice that they can close their eyes and then have the child describe what they just saw. And to kind of really deeply connect them to not just the experience of holding the rock or holding the feather, but then to close their eyes and be able to reimagine it again are great tools for helping children to feel calm in places where they might feel stressed or uncomfortable. So as we close things up, Emily, I want you to remind people again about Camp Natoma and the sessions, when it starts, how to find you.
Sure. Camp Natoma, we accept registrations online at campnatoma.org. It's N-A-T-O-M-A. We offer week-long, overnight, rustic, outdoor, nature-immersed camp programs for kids, first grade all the way through high school years. Our high schoolers do a leadership training program. Our first session starts the last week of June. That session is full, but we do have space for the remaining sessions throughout July and early August. And each session includes all sorts of recreational fun activities like arts and crafts and swimming and archery, but also, as we've been discussing today, opportunities for connecting with nature, learning about how to safely do activities in nature, as well as learning about the animals and plants that live here on the Central Coast.
And then family camp is a great introduction.
Yeah, we also have a family camp. It's really fun. It's a multi-generational weekend event. It's June 21st through 23rd. You can register still online for that event. And we have I'll have my three-month-old there. So we'll have a three-month, four-month-old. And we often have alumni come out to the camp who were campers in the 40s and 50s come, and everyone in between. And it's a really unique community of getting to do the fun things of summer camp, while also maybe there's families that have never been out there before or haven't really had a camping opportunity, and we make it easy. All you need to do is bring your stuff, your clothing, and a sleeping bag, and we provide all the other camping necessities, food and activities and safety, things like that.
It's a great thing for grandparents, too, maybe to take their grandchildren up, an easy way to introduce them to the outdoors. And don't forget that if you can't do a week of camp, you can throw your sleeping bag in the backyard. There are fabulous day camp opportunities, all sorts of nature-based day camps, campfire programs that have day camps that run this summer. Take a little bit of a deep dive into finding ways you can get your kids connected. So thank you, Emily, for being my guest today. This has been a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You can reach me by email, elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can follow me on my Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. Follow us on Instagram, Elizabeth_TRT. Listen to previous shows at kcbx.org or podcast to listen at your convenience. Thank you for being part of this conversation. Remember that it's Mental Health Awareness Month, and we are all responsible for taking care of our mental health. So do something small today that makes a big impact in the long run. Thank you for supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.